Hello, hello, and welcome to the Cycling Central podcast, where we wrap the week's action and put it in greaseproof paper for your easiest consumption. I'm Al Hines. This week on the show, it's literally the final last hurrah farewell thing 04 Cadell with the Cadell Evans Great Ocean Road Race. God, that's a mouthful. The Sun Tour is on. There's people racing in the desert, and we've got another hour to talk about the hour record, that is. And with me this week, Rob, Phil, but no Tan Man. It's the Cycling Central podcast without a Tan Man. It's a very different feeling, but I think it should be good all the same. Fellas, welcome.
Should I speak slowly just because Anthony's not here? I don't feel like I have to race talk this time.
So. Well, you can all just take lots of breaths and be very considered.
That's what I'll endeavour to do.
Yeah, good.
That's Rob here. Thanks, everyone, for tuning in. How are you, Phil?
I'm lovely, thank you.
Good, good.
Yes.
And it's been a...
Feeling suitably chastened.
Yeah?
Yeah.
By which?
Oh, well.
Just in general.
Just in general, yeah.
I mean by the readers.
Yeah, that's right.
That's a jab at the readers. All right. Anyway. All good.
The onset of cool. Has anyone noticed that it's really dark at 6 o'clock now?
It is.
It's goodbye to summer. It makes me feel like Milan San Remo's in the air. That's what I think.
And for us Australians, it's not really quite the point where the daylight saving gives you that sort of slight reprisal, doesn't it?
And to everyone in two-footer snow, I'm sorry.
We're sorry for complaining in our beautiful, lovely weather.
Oh, yeah, God, yeah. It's only 25 today.
I know. Oh, I
mean, misery.
Do I put the arm warmers on? Oh, no. All right, guys, let's get straight into it and talk about the hour record because it was a fascinating one. We'll get through there right after this quick break. Well, hours and hours. Jack Bobbage has now run and done his record attempt, and he rode 51.3 kilometres, which was further than Jens Voigt, but less than the current mark of Matthias Brandl, which was, an example of just how hard this record is and how it should not be underestimated, even by someone who is the current IP world record holder. Rowan Dennis, of course, will make his own attempt this Sunday in Switzerland, and there's a lot of anticipation about that one because... He may well be the guy that can get Brandl. It's on the same velodrome as Brandl. But Rob, first let's talk about Bobbage. We talked about him last. We sort of previewed the attempt, but it was something we haven't seen in Australia for a long, long time, obviously. Mm. And he threw everything at it. He came up a little bit short, but it certainly was an example of just how hard this is as a human effort.
I think you've published pieces about not being certain about how captivating the hour is. And I was uncertain. It was something I've never done. I think McGee's the only person who's done it in Australia. And of course, Anna Wilson, she's had a go since I've been doing my thing. And I didn't see either of those. And I was really intrigued of what would come of the Bobbage night. And even we turned up at the velodrome hours beforehand and I took my nine-year-old son to come along and have a look and sort of savour the atmosphere. So we got to watch it build, and by the time that Jack climbed onto the bike, it was absolutely a buzz. Like it was a big thrill. I've been following cycling professionally for over 20 years, and this is one of the best things I've been involved in. Mm. Okay, he missed the mark, but everything around it really gelled with me. Maybe it was because I had my son there and it was sort of, we had real close proximity to the star and we could, but when he climbed off the bike and there was chalk in his mouth almost, he was so, so dehydrated, so physically in a woeful state, it left me shaken. And if you have a look on, we published a little piece on YouTube with some, it's large of how I saw the evening and the comments that Jack made afterwards. And it was wonderful. He had wonderful humour. He was in a such a state that if you looked at his legs when he was giving the interview, his actual, the cramp was physically, you could see it. You could see these spasms of muscle going up and down his legs. And he was laughing about how much pain he was in, but you could really feel it. It was a remarkable sense of
pain.
Yeah, because he was locked into the pedals. They had to really rip his feet out, and you could hear his cries of pain. And when you're looking at someone's legs, and it's almost as though there's a being inside of them, and the muscles are spasming to such a point where it's you're watching it happen. It's really quite, yeah.
I mean, it's one of those things, I think, where a broadcast is never going to do the effort justice when you're looking at something from a bird's eye view of this guy going around a velodrome. It doesn't necessarily evoke that sort of that suspense, that passion, the amount of work that's going into it all. There was a good video, actually, I think, also that you posted, Rob, which was about, well, it was a budget video,
yes, but
a repost, which was very good, sort of captured a lot of the aftermath, you know, of Bob Bridge really just looking completely out of it at the end. And I think, you know, that's where you would love to see sort of some better broadcast infrastructure really illustrate a lot of that stuff. But also, I think, Phil, you know, with the Voight record, which is obviously a little bit back in time now, there was some really nice stuff which they did throughout it. You know, they brought a lot of data into it. There was a lot of overlay in the vision. There was good power and sort of technical analysis. And there was interviews which weren't just sort of, you know, audio grabs throughout the... And that sort of stuff would really enliven it. But
First of all,
yep.
The Bob, what happened with Bob Bridge,
yep,
right? If you think about it as a story,
yep,
like a Greek tragedy or whatever, right? It's the not getting the record in many ways,
yep,
right, is much more of a story than actually getting the record, because you can see how hard this is. But then you talk about the Voight record and Matthias Brandle getting the record as well. Yeah, we had a lot more of that. But in some ways, the way I've looked at this is Jack's effort, to me, looked more... How do I put this? Violently human, as opposed to
everyday man can consider the pain because of the way that he responded.
That's right. Yeah. Whereas the other two, with Yenzi and with Matthias, you know, there was obviously Jack did the same. I mean, there's still a lot of science behind this, right?
Yeah.
It's a lot of science and preparation, but it was more at the front of what Matthias and Jens did. Whereas with Jack, it seemed like once you got halfway into the event, it really became man and machine.
I mean,
there was a fight there. There was like, you know, two guys punching each other, and that came through towards the end as well. So I felt that had more impact for me, from that point of view. Just seeing this guy just absolutely rip himself apart to try and do this, which is going to make the Rowan thing a little bit more interesting. Which I think with Rowan at the moment, my sense is we're going to go back to what we saw with Matthias, for example, where it looks a little bit more well-timed, if you know what I mean.
Incredibly professional, yeah.
Professional,
sort of build up.
You know.
Yeah.
Do you understand?
Yeah,
do you get what I mean by that?
Yeah.
Jack looked organic.
Yeah, yeah.
And he rode on emotion.
Emotion,
like you can see, because otherwise he wouldn't have done those ridiculously fast laps at the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, even... There's so many things to consider, but his handlebars for the first few laps, they were only 30 centimetres wide, the non-aero ones, and that's... I stood next to the bike and I thought about how awkward it would be to ride, because it is so significantly narrow with the actual bullhorns, the bits that he had to use to start, yet still he ripped out really fast first laps. He was riding a 55-14, I think, 106-inch gear he was on. And he went very fast, and he wanted to maintain a schedule that would lead him to a 54-kilometre mark. So he was very ambitious, and they realised at around the 20-minute mark that they had to sort of pull back on that. But they wanted him riding 16.9 laps, 16 seconds, 16.9 seconds. And then... He was holding in the mid-17s for a while, and then every now and again, close to the midway mark, around 100 laps, he dropped a few, and they went down to 18.5, 18.6, you know, and it was sort of like, uh-oh, he's just got to lift here. And it was, you could see that it was fascinating to watch all of the things that were going on, but the time chart really does tell a big story, you know. Yeah. He just went too hard. I think if he paced himself a little bit differently, then we'd have a different story.
It's an interesting... I mean, my fascination with, I suppose, the old record was that sort of timelessness of it, you know, and the fact that now we're setting a new benchmark. But now that the benchmark is being sort of established, it does create this new fascination with this new benchmark. But what fascinated me particularly was this sort of idea that... You know, and I think it was shown in, you know, the shots, particularly just before when Bob Bridge was doing it. But there's this guy, a lone figure, about to tackle something where it's just him on a velodrome. It's almost, I know there was music playing, but it felt like sort of an eerie sort of situation, mm-hmm. because he's out there by himself. It's not like any other sort of sporting pursuit in that sense. On a velodrome, everyone is watching this guy just go around. And you know, if he feels like he's behind, or if he feels like he's ahead, or he's riding these emotions, he can feel that tenfold because he knows, oh, I've gone out a bit hard. Suddenly I'm a bit nervous. Everyone is aware of that. It's like a hyper awareness.
Mm. Oh, it was fantastic. Yeah. I mean, now, the velodrome's great for that because, sorry, you go, Phil.
Now I think Al is starting to get what the hour record is all about.
It does. It gives me goosebumps. It's fantastic. What was, for me, a big pleasure of the velodrome is that you have the capacity to watch an event but also wander around. And it's a pursuit. You can sit still for 4 minutes and watch figure out, you know, where they're good, where they're bad, what if they're rocking their hips too much or different things. But with an hour, you've got that. You can't just sit there watching the rider time and time again. So I was talking with Tim Looning, the owner of Budget Forklifts, the team that sponsored him, and the Soigneurs, and Luke Davison, who's a teammate, and he was giving me his take on things. And I never stopped talking with people the whole night and getting their perspectives on it. And also just sitting there to watch him come past us, and you think, oh, he looks so efficient, looks so fabulous. But the thing that really struck me the most about the hour, and this sounds dumb in retrospect, but think about this. If I sit on the rollers for half an hour, I sweat like a pig, if a pig sweats. I sweat like something that sweats a lot.
I feel like a pig probably sweats.
And that's just an effort. But in that half-hour session, I've drunk a bidden or two.
Yeah.
You know, so I'm looking after myself. In the middle of the night after the hour, I woke up and thought to myself, he didn't drink. It's really obvious he doesn't drink because he's in the tuck and that's how it is on the track. And if he'd had a drink, he would have smashed it. But to
do you reckon?
Imagine doing an hour. I mean, there must be in the rules that you can't drink. I have to check. But he didn't drink. Sure. And you do an hour. And of course you're dehydrated and of course you're cramping because your body needs that nutrition. Mm. Even if he had a water, he would have done the extra two laps. I have absolutely no doubt. Because when he pulled up, he was dry. He was completely wrecked.
A husk.
And he had, I keep saying, this chalk on his lips. It wasn't. It was just total
salt.
Like just salt and dried saliva and just sheer emptiness.
Yeah.
And I think it's a little bit brutal. It's so gladiatorial to not have a drink when you're doing 51.3 kilometres in an hour for an hour. It's just...
I suppose...
That's the take home for me.
I'd be interested to know if that is a rule or not. I mean, I'm sure it might... I imagine it would have been something more to do with they didn't want to have a cage on the bike and they wouldn't want to have necessarily a camelback because it might disturb his position.
Hmm. Well, if you could, you'd want to do it. You'd have to do it. Yeah, I know that, you know, Matt Gilmore told me the old trick of the Madison years ago, and every track he knows it is you chuck a quarter of lemon in your sleeve and you reach over and you have a chew of that, and that ignites the saliva producing mechanism. And so that's what guys do when they're doing a Madison and they can't take their hands off the bar, they can't drink. I mean, drinking on the track isn't something that you do.
No.
You don't see track racing with people with biddens.
And you can't because water could get on the track as well on the boards. All hell would break loose.
A disaster. Yeah. But just when you're thinking about that and you're thinking about the efforts that you've done in the gym or on the rollers or on the bike, just recognise that you've been drinking or you have the ability to drink and he didn't. And then... put yourself through that torture and it's phenomenal.
Mm.
Absolutely amazing.
So let's leave Bobridge there for a second, but Dennis coming up this Sunday, and you sort of talked about it being a bit more of a BMC Swiss precision sort of operation, but he's also, I would probably wager, is it probably a better informed time trials than Bobridge has been, certainly in the last maybe 12 months. And I think he beat him at Nationals by a little bit on a similar distance, similar sort of amount of time. Rob, maybe start with you, but do you think that he can edge Brundle? And also, do you have an appreciation perhaps for Brundle's effort? I mean, I feel like a lot of people were
absolutely dismissed. Yeah. But I mean, I watched Brundle from afar. I didn't. The only hour I've watched, I haven't watched it on the streaming. I've seen the pictures of Voigt and from back in 93 and 94 when O'Brien
Grainy
and Boardman were doing it.
YouTube
I've been
clips.
Following it very closely, but I've never watched one live until Bobridge.
Mm.
And I learned a lot from that, and I learned that Matthias Brundle is bloody amazing.
Yeah.
And what he did was phenomenal, and congratulations. And let's not just think that it just was an hour that passed and he is now this anonymous guy who's got a record. No, he's superstar.
Yeah.
And I totally, like Jack and like Rowan now do, I'm sure they applaud him and think fantastic.
Mm. Yeah.
Will Rowan break it? I think so. Yeah, I'm pretty confident.
Do you think he would have looked at Bobridge's attempt and sort of looked, they'll probably be analysing some aspects of it as well?
Yeah, I called Rowan the other night and asked him to give Jack a call. I think they should talk to one another and just figure out, you know, what happened.
Well, sorry, go ahead. Yeah.
I think there's a couple of things that have been raised about Bobridge's hour and why he perhaps missed out. And a lot of people are speculating that the efforts at Tour Down Under might have taxed him. I don't agree. And I talked about that last week in the podcast. I think it was good training. Yeah. But the night before, or two nights before, he did do the team's pursuit at the Nationals, and he was doing three-lap turns, where others on his team were doing half-lap or one-lap turns. And they came third in the team pursuit. I wonder if that might have just been
a little bit too much, a bridge too far.
You know, you can understand his enthusiasm for wanting to be back on a fixed gear, on a track bike, to feel his form, to race, to get that vibe, to do all of the things that he did it for. But I just wonder if that might have been
a massive 500 metres.
Yeah.
Well, exactly. Rowan.
Yeah, I think I'm pretty confident. I mean, I was confident that Jack would do it as well. I didn't actually know about the fact that I didn't even think about that him doing work at Track Nationals. It didn't even cross my mind. But yeah, I think I would agree with that. That may have taken some of the edge off. But I think Rowan, I think he's got a very good chance of edging it out. I feel pretty confident about that.
I feel for Tim Decker, who was calling Bobridge's hour, you know, like he had the sole responsibility. He was asking the people in the infield, please, in the first few laps, please just pop your heads down so I can see how he's progressing. He was obvious. Tim was very anxious. I spoke to him about it afterwards. Rowan told me a couple of weeks ago that he wasn't sure who was going to call his hour, but he expects that there'll be multiple people, some trainers and soigneurs from BMC. So we'll see how that's all plays out.
But wasn't that the situation with IAM as well? It was pretty much a similar setup with IAM, with Brandler.
I'm not sure.
It was really the team, you know, the team really handled all that. Mm-hmm. So I don't know, maybe that's...
I don't think Bobridge could have had anyone better in his corner to call it. I mean, Decker is, you know, he knows, he's an expert at these sort of, you know, really well-defined efforts. So.
But I think he would rethink it and say we should have started a lot slower. Especially knowing, even like Davison was telling me, at about 150 laps, so we're getting close to three-quarter time, Luke was saying he'll be all right. He thrives on suffering. You know, he'll come home. He'll bring it on strong. But that's sort of talking about a guy who, you know, is able to reach for a drink. And your body responds differently when you're completely flat and empty.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sure he did everything right in advance, and he drank a lot, and he had the right mix and this and that. But I just think that maybe that lesson will serve Rowan very well.
So I think, well, you're gonna be talking to Rowan.
Yeah, you're going to talk to him overnight this evening. Yeah.
So yeah, there's some good, good fodder there.
There's a lot to talk about, and it'll be interesting to see how nervous he is now as well. Because I think now that Bobridge has laid it all out there and come up slightly short, I'm certain that there's going to be a little bit in the back of your head going, well,
a doubt now.
Well, that Brandl's record is nothing to sneeze about, which you know, I don't know if we ever did say specifically, people did.
It's
because sort of subconscious.
Yeah, it's because we're in new ground, a bit new ground with the rule changes and everything else. So nobody knows exactly what the record looks like, right? And now we're getting a much better sense of what the record is.
I hadn't even really put it into my calculations of the lap times. But when you're thinking about wanting to ride 16 nines, lap after lap after lap for 210 laps, it's pretty... go out to the velodrome, everyone. This is a lesson for the everyday rider because it's so tangible. You can think about how many people that are listening to this broadcast have ridden an hour and not even felt tired from that effort.
Yep.
Okay, pretty much everyone has. An hour is not a big deal. If you get the luxury of 4 or 5 hours on the road bike, then that's when you start really feeling like you've done yourself some physical, you know, favours or disservice, depending on your perspective. But go onto a velodrome and have a good solid workout for an hour and it'll feel like you've been on the road for 10. And this is a great opportunity for everyone to recognise the beauty of track cycling. From a mountain biker, BMXer, everyone, roadie, there's something...
pure.
Something gorgeous about a fixed gear and just the board
pure.
And just the the constant loop ahead of you.
Yeah. Well, there's the well, if you're in Australia, well, there's the Adelaide Superdrome, you've got Dunk Grey, and then you've got Disc. I mean, you've got plenty of good fodder
there in. There is. There's a lot of indoor velodromes. There's a lot of outdoor velodromes. It ought not to be a dying sport, and hopefully this is going to reinvigorate the good old way that track cycling once was in Australia.
All right, guys, let's wrap the hour up because we're going to probably be analysing it all next week, whether Rowan gets the record or not. But until then, let's move on and talk about another race that we did talk about a little bit last week, but that is the Cadell Evans Great Ocean Road Race. Well, Yanni Meersman took out the inaugural Cadell race, and it turned out to be quite a corker of an event with, you know, thrilling racing to the finish, lots of breakaways, a touch of bad weather, but on the most part, you'd have to say that it ticked all the boxes of something we don't see as much televised in Australia, and that's single-day racing, and what single-day racing actually means. You know, a whole peloton leaving it totally out there, and you know, eventually we saw people like Evans and Meersman come to the fore towards the end of the race, but we also saw the brakes sort of threatening, we saw the peloton shattering probably halfway through the race. These are sort of things you see in things like Paris-Roubaix, Amstel Gold, and small little breaks of the hitters of the sport, but in stage races it tends to, you know, it's so much more controlled by the nature of them. But I thought it was an excellent exhibition of what this race could do potentially in the future and where it could go, because races like that, maybe races like Warrnambool, it'd be great to see them on television more often.
Absolutely. I went after the hour, we drove on down to Geelong and caught the vibe. And I think it's a big gamble doing a one-day race, because you've got this enormous infrastructure that has to be put in place. And I guess there's the advantages of having a stage race in the sense that you have that follow-up. But this was all or nothing for one day, and it was sort of a race that came together. I wrote a piece saying in a little bit of haste, because they knew that Cadell was retiring and they wanted to make sure that he was in the event. So, but the organisation was phenomenal, and the broadcast was excellent. The PR in advance with references to cycling during the Australian Open tennis and all of that comes with it was very good for the thing. I think Victoria turned on a great show. The weather certainly wasn't ideal, but that added to the drama of the actual spectacle. So I think, and that didn't seem to dampen the spirit of the crowd. There was heaps of people there. There was a great vibe. It was, and the show that was put on was spectacular. Mm. And the fact that it was on the 2000, well, bits and pieces of it, the last few circuits,
2010
Worlds Course, it was a big advantage, because a lot of people went there. And a lot of people understand what those climbs are like. And, I could talk about it for a little while. So you tell me when to stop.
I'm having a hard time coming up with anything to say, because that pretty well sums it up for me. I enjoyed it, like, just as a fan. I mean, obviously we weren't the host broadcaster for it, so it was interesting to watch a race from that perspective, because obviously we broadcast one-day races like Milan-San Remo and Paris-Roubaix, et cetera. So, you know, we've got... You know, we're used to that. So it's interesting to see someone else cover that and to see how it's covered. And I can't fault Seven, the organizers, Victoria, Tourism.
Major events, yeah.
Events.
Robbie McHugh and Matt Keenan for their commentary. Yeah.
Can we talk about Robbie on the motorcycle?
Yeah.
I mean, how good was that?
No, that has been done a little bit in other races, but, you know, we don't get to see it as much. And so it certainly needs to happen at the tour.
So how good was that moment when Robbie went and just interviewed Cadell in the middle of the race, and
well, he basically just ignored him, didn't he?
Well, it looked that way, but you know, I think, you know, I'd love to see more of that actually happen at dud points in a road race where, you know, everybody's just kind of soft pedaling along and they're just sort of the brakes up the road or whatever, and there's time to do that. I think if a broadcast has that kind of flexibility, I think in the right hands with the right rider, that would be a really unique kind of perspective and moment to capture.
They've had Jalabert doing that for years at the tour.
Yeah, yeah, but he's French.
And he's got good insight, but I think, you know, Robbie is just outstanding.
Yeah.
And the way that he he understands broadcasting, and he understands selling cycling, and he understands what the viewer wants, and he understands what the bike rider wants, and he doesn't want to get in anyone's face. And you could see when he actually did ask Cadell a question, there was a moment of uncomfortable. You could almost feel the producer in his ear going, come on, ask him a question. And Robbie going, yeah, but it's going to suck.
And it did.
Cadell, you're there in the race. Yes,
but again, that's my point, right? The point is that, you know, with a willing subject in the peloton, somebody who's well known for being, effusive and, interesting to talk to.
Yeah.
Not that Cadell isn't, but, you know.
Yeah, a Jens Voigt-esque character catching up in the middle of the peloton.
Would make for some amazing television.
Well, also it gives you that insight into what you don't get in cycling races, where potentially you get in things like, I suppose, other sports which have like a half-time break, which is that sort of middle of the event, the players actually giving a bit of insight as to what they're thinking, what was going on. Mm-hmm. And that's what that sort of live bike gives you, because it's like the rider's actually going, well, this is what's going on at the moment, and this is what we're thinking. And it brings the viewer in a little bit more. So they're like, oh, okay, so what the commentators were saying was quite kind of right, but there's also this going on, and sort of colours it in a little bit more. But one thing I want to say as well, Phil, is that Ben Swift, he said after the race that this was a real endorsement for circuit racing, which I think isn't really done as much at World Tour level. It's often these big sort of lumbering courses around. And I know, Liège sort of comes back and some of these other races, but we often forget that sort of these short 10, 15-kilometre circuits, you have a bit of a work up to it, but once you get on them, it really dictates the racing style after that.
Yeah, and I think it also satisfies one of the things that cycling usually misses, which is we don't have arenas, right? So having these types of loops creates this whole idea of an arena, which I think is great. You have lots of fans on the course, et cetera. So,
well, Buninyong, though, Phil. I mean, that's the classic, isn't it? That's the example that you've got to come back to, which is the a 10.1-kilometer circuit, which everyone can get on, and there's a small descent and there's a bit of a climb. Yeah. But those sort of things are golden for spectators. And I think, to be honest, riders tend to like them as well, because it's almost like you've got that sort of stadium aspect. Okay, I've got that climb that we hit every single time up. Mm. I'm going to hit it on the third to go and then see how the peloton reacts, and I can do the same thing again, and you can replicate your actions and see what happens. I don't know, it feels a bit more tactical in some ways. But
yeah, you become familiar with it. You're like, okay, we've seen that before. And the riders do as well, and they race accordingly. But I think that the quest for that race was to show off Victoria. Okay, they didn't have the greatest weather, but they did roll along the Great Ocean Road, and there was some spectacular scenery, and it showed off Cadell's backyard. I remember when they were driving through Barwon Heads, and I thought, oh yeah, if you just keep going straight ahead there and you take a right, then you go to, that's where Cadell's lives when he's in Australia. And that was a fitting tribute to the end of a remarkable career. And that's one thing that we were really there for. And for him to come fifth, I think, is just so, I don't know, serendipitous in the sense that in 1994, on the 31st of July...
He was on the World Cup podium.
And he created a five platform World Cup podium. And that would be that way forevermore.
Starts and ends on fifth.
And for him to finish on fifth, I think it's whatever, take it or leave it. But I liked it.
Just on sort of what you mentioned, Rob, in terms of it is his last race. And you're right, that was a lot of the reason for the race even taking place in some ways, a celebration of Cadell's career and, yes, certainly the Victorian tourism aspect. But that won't be there, I know, other than in name. Evan's impact won't be there in the same way next year, and it certainly won't be there in the future. Is that something that is a concern, I suppose, for
organisers?
Let's just
call it the Great Ocean Road Race.
It served
a great purpose to have it called the Cadell Evans Great Ocean Road Race, but I got sick of riding it all.
CEG.
Great Ocean Road Race serves me well. I mean,
Copy and paste.
I was very pleased. Originally, it was announced as Cadell Evans something or other.
Classic or something.
And I had tweeted facetiously and rudely, and I apologise. But how can it be a classic when it's the first one?
Yeah.
But that's just, that's the ambition. But it became a classic race. It was a really good race. It was super cool. And I spoke with Marino Moser in advance, or just before the start, and he was telling me, it's going to be great. It's going to be more like an under-23 race, where it's going to be mayhem, because there's basically, you know, 50% world tour and 50% domestic teams. And the domestic teams knew that there was going to be live television, which they don't, they rarely get. Let's put on a big show. They did put on a big show. There was attacks and this and that and all sorts of things going on. It took a while to get warmed up, but that's how road racing is. It was a big gamble to go 4.5 hours live. But they took that risk and there wasn't a big flat spot. And the flat spot was when they got to sell Victoria. So
Can we just talk for a moment about the size of the field, like the number of riders per team? I mean, how did you see that affecting the race? I think that the reduced numbers actually made for better racing. I think there were no race radios as well.
Race radios.
Six rider teams, was it? Or five?
Five.
I think it was six. Six or seven.
No, it wasn't seven.
No. It was small. And Cadell commented afterwards about that, saying that that changed the dynamic of the race. So, but I don't know. I think that the smaller peloton, or because of the smaller number of riders in every team, it does change the dynamic. Not having radios was excellent. Because Nathan, for example, I thought, here we go. Marino was attacking on the last lap, you might remember, and he got an advantage of 6 or so seconds. And I was thinking, this is an interesting move because he's not going to sprint. He's not going to hold him off. But he's obviously luring the others forward so that Nathan can follow wheels and then pump him in the sprint. And I spoke with Nathan the other day and he sort of insinuated that that wasn't exactly the tactic. So, you know, interesting things come from different things. Maybe Marino was thinking that and who knows?
Yeah.
Just on that as well, though, race radios, domestic teams in the race, those are things which could be compromised if, as Evans wants it to be, a world tour race. That's only his wish. I know that Simon Clark was less convinced by that pursuit, but would it be a good, would it be a natural fit for a world tour race, or do you like that sort of downstep position, you know, that sort of five world tour teams, some domestic, some continental teams ahead of the Sun Tour?
Maybe just thinking as I speak, isn't the main...
Isn't that what you always do, Rob?
Generally. Isn't the main catalyst of wanting an event to be world tour is that you guaranteed, like as part of the recognition, a good field and also the broadcast and subsequent publicity, you know? So if you're already getting the broadcast, fantastic. If you don't have to have a full world tour budget, when you have to fly many more teams over and spend a lot more money, then you can invest more into the publicity and the broadcast and the on-site facilities. And they had three large screens and all that sort of thing that came with it.
The necessity is necessarily there.
I think they've got all of the things that they need without it being World Tour. So it's a bit like Europcar. Why would you pay a World Tour license when you know you're going to the Tour de France?
Yeah. But at the same time, I think, you know, having a World Tour single-day race is the next logical event for Australia.
Whether that be in five or ten years.
Yeah, I think it's something that that will obviously have to be considered at some point.
All right.
And whether if it's that race, then that's fantastic. I think the course is great. If it rains, even better.
Yeah. But, I mean, just to say a couple of things about Miesman, because the cream did end up rising. And I think that in advance of Tour Down Under, for example, Quickstep or Etics Quickstep was saying that they thought Miesman was good for the win,
and he wasn't.
He did everything right in this race, and he was there, and he picked up the win.
Yep.
And just by the way, let's reference the winner. Bit of the conversation.
I mentioned him at the very start. Right?
No, but that was me. I've talked about tourism and broadcast and Robbie McEwen and Matt Keenan and
Gianni.
And I thought, let's chuck in this Belgium.
Rob. On that note, let's just quickly wrap up and move on. And we've got one final thing to talk about with touching on the Sun Tour, and then we'll get the end of this podcast done. All right, just quickly, the Jacob Herald Sun Tour, of course, running this week. The Dubai Tour also running. Ladies Tour of Qatar, we're well and truly into the racing season now with plenty of events going on all over the world. And Mark Cavendish won overnight. Will Clark is winning in Australia at the Sun Tour. It's good to see, I suppose, that these races are going on. But to be honest, just quickly on the desert races, they never totally captivate me, other than maybe the, you know, you have that one windy day where it just gets blown to pieces.
Haven't you? You went last year?
A couple of years ago now. It was, you know, they're interesting when Tom Bonin, you know, and Quickstep get to the front of it and they sort of practice their classics, you know, riding, you know, and people like Cancellara and Taylor Finney feature. But, you know, on the days where nothing happens, it is not as impressive.
No, it's because the courses are flat, et cetera. But that's exactly what happened in the women's race.
And Chloe Hosking.
Ladies Tour Qatar last night.
Yeah.
Right. So there was lots of wins. Peloton got split to pieces.
Yep.
And then, of course, we had
Ellen van Dijk,
just a terrific bike rider, perfect for those conditions. And that course throws up that kind of winner, and that's what you get.
Yeah.
The Dubai Tour, on the other hand, right? Basically, they could have just run a 6-second drag race, and that would have been it. So,
which you sort of poked fun at by posting just a Vine,
a 6-second Vine, of the highlights video.
Well, is that just the prelude to what I think we're talking about the Middle East? So when we say the desert, so I know that these Qatar and is has been around the longest, and Dubai is new, but the Tour of Oman is the one that really gets me.
I would
have been lobbying hard to go to this race. Unfortunately, deadline doesn't work and I'm not going, but I'm definitely going to Oman to go riding because it's hilly. It's got wonderful
sort of
roads.
Temperate aspect
it's got
to it.
Oman really captivates me. I think the imagery that you get from there, it's a total contrast to what we're getting at the moment, where it just basically looks like riding on a road through a bunch of sand.
Yeah,
and skyscrapers.
Yeah, and weird glitzy sky. It's an alien atmosphere. I think a lot of people say that when they go there. But we will look.
And furthermore, selling Oman a little bit more. It's the idea that you have Nibali making his season debut. I think is Froome going
and declaring that he wants to win it.
And Contador was there last year, putting on a big show. We saw Evans have a good ride there last year. We saw lots of different things. We won't see Cadell in Oman, that's for sure. But I think
he will be at Rowan Dennis's Hour Record, though.
Firing the gun, they say.
Yeah, that's it.
We talked about that last week.
Yep.
How exciting. Let's go repetition on the pod.
And a quick word about the Jacob Herald Sun Tour.
Yep.
Big Horse won the prologue.
Will Clark is in the jersey.
Will Clark's in the jersey. The prologue was held in Melbourne.
Yep. They've repeated that formula, which is a really good, successful formula. Crazily narrow circuit if you've actually looked at the vision. I'm almost surprised that there weren't a few little incidents just by people not concentrating and sort of hitting a barrier because it's very narrow, but insane speeds. A 2.1 kilometre, I think, was
short
it? You know, it's just like, it's basically a sprint.
That's fantastic. And to have Will Clark beating Caleb Ewan, that's, you know,
that's what we want.
That's a great bit of diversity. Yeah.
Anyway, obviously the race will have highlights all this week and final stage Sunday, Arthur's Seat, always a classic. If you can get up there, if you're in Victoria, that is well worth doing because it's not very far away from the city. But guys, we'll leave it there for the Sun Tour and we'll talk about that all when we get some nice little results. One final thing, we'll talk quickly about our just something else. Something else. We'll talk about it soon. All right, well, we always have the comment of...
You knew exactly where you were going, didn't you?
We always have the comment of the week at the end here, and this week is actually an exception because Phil has vetoed the comment that I was going to use, but basically, if you saw a post that we had on Facebook with a guy in a large lamprey outfit, it was something around that. All we can say is that we found the response slightly bemusing.
Well, it's... No, look, I'll fess up, okay, because...
In
adding the image, I said, I'm sure we're going to get pinged for fat shaming.
Yep.
And sure enough, we were. And for that, I apologize. But, you know, when you're trying to publish something with a certain take.
Which is very playful.
That's right. At the same time, you know, a certain type of editorial license has to be taken. And there's always a fine line. Some may feel you've walked over it, and others may go with the spirit in which the article or post or whatever you want to call it was published.
I feel like it's a funny line. It's always one of these funny lines where people, you know, there's always going to be people who take an offense to a joke, but ultimately it is coming from a point of humor. You're not trying
to... No, absolutely not. Yeah. Absolutely not. And but this is the world we live in, and, you know, so this is where we are.
Oh, yeah.
But... The question was answered. is Cadell a mammal?
Yeah, and I think...
And the answer was, he's on his way.
He's on his way, almost. Very, very close.
What was... I'm out of this loop.
No, that's don't worry, Rob, it's too late. We can't talk about it, but I will direct you to the Cycling Central website where you will find a litany of comments about it and, you know, criticising it, whatever, loving it. It was a bit of fun, you know, as we do on a Wednesday, Tuesday.
And to be quite honest, the audience enjoyed the post thoroughly based on the traffic.
Well, exactly. And we
got through a whole podcast and we didn't talk about doping.
Actually, you have to say it, didn't you? Can we talk about car crashes and ice?
Yeah, in Aspen, right.
Did anyone go pause? No. Hang on. Wait, one's due.
Pelizotti's at Sun Tour. Anyway, let's...
that's nasty.
All right, guys. Let's wrap it up. Phil, thanks. Been a pleasure. Rob, it's always been good. For everyone else, thanks for joining us. Don't forget, for all your news, blogs, videos, pics and more, we're always creating more content at sbs.com.au/cyclingcentral. Don't forget the hour record this Sunday on SBS2. I think that's about it. See you later. Bye.